You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
So hear this story from Mark 7, 24 to 30. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice. And a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him. And she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, found the child lying on the bed, and the demon gone. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
He had the ability to teach us startling new perspectives with a gentle touch. His calm, inviting delivery let us see what he was suggesting about our fundamental understanding of the historical Jesus. We were able to see how he modelled critical thinking and reflection. He made us comfortable with our discomfort at relinquishing cherished notions and opinions. He taught me that when we think critically, no one has to suffer. No one has to be made the enemy. If you haven't already guessed, that was an online tribute to Marcus Borg, a leader within progressive Christianity. Marcus died in January this year. I honour his integrity, scholarship, and personal character. I dedicate this sermon to his memory. What an interesting and different story from the gospel tradition. A single entry story by the anonymous storyteller we call Mark, of which David alluded to with the children this morning. It not only paints Jesus in a not so positive light, but also seems to question the very spirituality that initially shaped him. Having redefined clean and unclean in a previous story, Mark now has Jesus challenged, and by implication, his Markan community somewhere in Syria, to put that teaching into practice by ministering to those often seen as unclean or just different. Or as we might say in our everyday language, take the time to look beyond external factors, which by their nature often excludes. So to use a Borg saying, what lens did the storyteller use and why? What lens can we use to hear this story with 21st century ears? Several years ago, I was on the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, Australia, attending the fourth national gathering of the Network of Biblical Storytellers Australia-New Zealand. As it happened, it was a group which I was instrumental in setting up in 1990 throughout Australia and New Zealand. Queensland is the northern state of Australia, with summer temperatures perhaps similar to Arizona, the highest ever summer temperature recorded was 49.5 degrees Celsius. Let me convert that, 121.1 degrees Fahrenheit. And that happened in Birdsville in 1972. Queensland, desert to the west, channel country and some rainforests are in the middle, and the famous but diminishing Great Barrier Reef along the eastern coast. For years, its tourist catch cry was, "Beautiful one day, perfect the next." There you are, David, I've put the plug in, because in Brisbane next year will be the fourth International Common Dreams Conference at which you are all invited to attend. Now, the keynote speaker at the gathering that I attended was feminist theologian and Catholic religious Miriam Therese Winter. Those have heard of her. Okay. It was a truly wonderful and stimulating experience, and I invite you to, at some stage, embrace some of her thinking and her works. It was also an awakening experience for many of us males, as we began to hear some of the biblical stories through the eyes and ears, through the lens of women. So in that spirit, let me offer a couple of more comments on Mark's story. The storyteller's lens, a Phoenician woman, and her unconventional behaviour as determined by social convention bested Jesus. If we believe the storyteller, it caught him on the raw, so to speak. What initially draws the dominant male's wrath by its increasing boldness, cleverness, and basic moral correctness eventually subverts that discomfort into agreement. Mark's Jesus had already taught others that religious customs should not stand in the way of doing good for those in need. Now, Mark suggests, Jesus is faced with having to learn that social conventions ingrained in his spirituality should not do that either. And if it was good enough for Jesus to have a change of heart, then what seems implied in this story is why shouldn't it also be good enough for others, especially Mark's own community, to be so challenged? On the surface, the story is presented as one about healing. But I reckon if we dig a little deeper, we will find Mark intended it to be a story of inclusion and distributive justice, and where a woman becomes the lead actor or lens in the interaction. The storyteller's teaching moment seems to be people matter most. No one can be excluded. No one can be treated like dogs or unclean or outcast. None. The restoration of the individual is thus sacramental of the restoration of society. Let me change the lens. Arthur Dewey is an author, a progressive theologian, and a fellow of the Westar Institute Jesus Seminar. You have no doubt heard of them, even if you haven't heard of him. In one of his many articles, he explores the possibility of viewing Jesus through the lens of a peasant artisan or craftsman. Why? Dewey reckons this could help us work out what Jesus was on about. He writes, and I quote, "It appreciates the texture of his imagination. How did Jesus craft his words? What did he envisage as he worked? How did his words invite his listeners into his vision? What can we make of those words?" So, how does Dewey suggest Jesus went about crafting his words? Let me quote Dewey again. "Working in wood or stone demands envisioning what is there within the material. He sees what is there and works painstakingly towards it. The task is to see a vision and to use the grain in seeking to realize that vision." So what might artisan Jesus have seen what was there within his audience? I offer these suggestions and invite you to ponder them some more. Firstly, dispute the conventional wisdom that says one's primary concern should be for those within our own social group or clan or family or nationality. Two, admit there is a degree of alienation in society, be it towards Muslims, gays and lesbians, or so-called illegal immigrants, whom we or they often turn into the enemy. Three, challenge all to reshape their social categories, especially those of others, formed by fears and rumours and innuendo. How could this happen? Dewey suggests, can you imagine acting differently toward those outside the circle of your people? Not only to reimagine your response, but to offer your oppressor a chance to be a more humane reply. In short, practice Ubuntu. Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, I believe, explains the meaning of this Zulu word, Ubuntu. He writes, "We believe that a person is a person through another person, that my humanity is caught up, bound up inextricably with yours. When I dehumanize you, I dehumanize myself. The solitary human is a contradiction in terms, and therefore we seek to work for a common good because our humanity comes into its own in belonging." There are still many in our communities who know what it's like to be without a voice, to be flattened, to be destroyed. And when Christian politicians and pastors, you know the kind, you find them in legislative assemblies and all over Facebook, YouTube and Twitter, exclude or denigrate minority groups. No wonder others in the community think it is natural to also treat them, asylum seekers, gay, lesbian and transgender folk, the homeless, that way. Back home in Australia, We have a federal government that has adopted the abhorrent practice of locking up asylum seeker children in immigration detention centres, often in poor countries outside Australia. Those same detention centres have been described by the former Australian of the Year, Professor Patrick McGorry, as factories of mental illness. Back home in Australia, author Tim Winton said in his 2015 Palm Sunday address, and I quote, "We have an irrational phobia. We are afraid of strangers. Not rich strangers, no. The ones who frighten us out of our wits are the poor strangers. People displaced by war and persecution. We're even scared of their traumatised children. And if they flee their war-torn countries in boats, well then, they're twice as threatening." Back home in Australia, social commentator Hugh McKay calls this attitude disengagement. In a newspaper article some time back, he wrote, "We prefer TV programs about backyards to news and current affairs. We have rediscovered the healing power of retail therapy. We have become more self-absorbed. We're more prejudiced and correspondingly less interested in information that might challenge those prejudices." As a result, many, perhaps most, ignore the plight of others or think that trickle-down economics is the answer to every question, even, it seems, if the planet burns. Until a Phoenician woman, already with two strikes against her, gives the ignored or the forgotten a voice. Prophets come in all shapes and sizes. They don't look the way you would expect. Every generation must work out its values and its faith responses to changing circumstances, just as those who preceded us were required to do. Not everything passed down has the same value for life in the modern world, and we must discriminate. And that goes for science, for politics, for education, and for religion. Change is. When all is said and done, we actually live in a new present that is qualitatively different from any of our human pasts. In this present, as we think about ourselves and others, how do we find the energy to nurture a creative and compassionate lifestyle? A progressive colleague from New Zealand, Sir Lloyd Gearing, suggests we need to take with radical seriousness an attitude for awe towards this self-evolving universe, an appreciation of the living ecosphere of this planet, an appreciation of the captivity of the earth, of the capacity of the earth to regenerate itself, an appreciation of the total cultural legacy we have received from our human forebears. responsibility for the care for one another, responsibility for the kind of planet we pass on to our descendants. Its value to be found in life, in all its diversity. He goes on to say, in developing a spirituality for today's secular world, we must not be primarily concerned with saving our individual selves. Rather, we must be primarily concerned for the welfare of one another, for the future of the human species, and for the health of the planet. As you ponder further on all this, thus completing my sermon, may your creative imaginations become part of that ongoing discovery of new ways, a new lens to be a human community in the world, especially when everything around us seems fragile and unsure.
Thank you, Rex, so much for bringing us that word today.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.